Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Picture that super soft t-shirt you love sleeping in. The one that gets softer and softer the more you wear it. Now you can bring that same lived-in softness to your entire bed with Signature Vintage Wash Sheets from Boll & Branch. This all-new collection is even softer than your favorite t-shirt, with a distinctly relaxed look and feel for your best night's sleep. Just like all Boll & Branch bedding, Signature Vintage Wash Sheets start with the highest quality, 100% organic cotton. The lived and feel comes from a small batch washing process, creating a level of softness you've never felt before. And it's not just the feel. Boll & Branch mastered the laid-back aesthetic using a special technique that creates the well-loved look you'll find with vintage jeans. And true to the Boll & Branch hallmark, Signature Vintage Wash Sheets get softer and softer with every wash. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order with promo code ODYSSEY and save on their most relaxing sheets. So head to BollAndBranch.com today. That's B-O-L-L and Branch.com.
A word of warning, this podcast explores graphic and disturbing stories and includes some strong language. It therefore may not be suitable for our young listeners or other folks who may find it disturbing. Hello and welcome to True Crime Daily, the podcast covering high profile and under the radar cases from across the country every week. We are recording this on Wednesday, November 18th, 2020. I am your host, Anna Garcia, and we have an awesome guest today from the world of crime. We have a DNA scientist. So I'm really excited because, you know, DNA is how so much is being cracked, especially in cold cases. Our guest today, who's also our co-host, is David Middleman. Welcome, David. We're so excited you're here.
Thanks for having me.
So David is the founder and CEO of Othram, Inc. It is a biometrics company that uses DNA sequencing to solve some of the toughest cold cases. The lab is located in Woodlands, Texas, which is just north of Houston. David's team helped to crack an unsolved murder case, 17-year-old high school student who was killed nearly 50 years ago. That is one of the cases we're going to talk about today. Also, David has a PhD in molecular biophysics. David, before we get to our cases, I really want to ask you really how you do what you do, because I read one of your quotes that I was fascinated by. You said, "We take terrible evidence that other labs won't touch." What does that mean?
So a lot of, you know, a lot of the cold cases, the older ones, there's DNA that's been left at the scene. There's some DNA evidence left. But there's something that makes it unsuitable for testing, at least using standard methods. Maybe there's not enough DNA left. Maybe the DNA is degraded. When DNA gets old, it breaks into little itty-bitty pieces. Maybe it's been contaminated with bacteria or other non-human things. Lots of things can happen to DNA over 50 years. And so if the DNA is not suitable, if it can't be accepted for other methods, we love taking those cases on because we don't want any case to get left behind. And you know, once you're out of evidence, the case has truly gone cold. As long as there's evidence, there's something to do. And so we specialize specifically in evidence that has failed other methods or has been through other labs and has not produced information that is valuable to an investigation. We take that evidence and apply our methods to try to get as much information as we can for investigators.
In the world of DNA technology, do you have to have, I guess, what would be called like an entire sequence that almost clearly identifies the individual? Or can you work with bits of DNA that say, okay, we can narrow it down to maybe this field of people?
Yeah, I think in forensics, it's, you know, you're not going to expect to get every little piece of information. You're usually working from fragments or small. And I think you're right. It's definitely a narrowing down. Even before you get to DNA, that's really what an investigation is the law enforcement side, which really drives the investigation. They're constantly trying to eliminate possibilities until they're left with very few possibilities left. And the same is true in DNA testing. You start with the possibility that anyone that has DNA could be involved. That's all of us. And then through iterative analysis and testing, you can narrow down and then continuously eliminate folks until you're left with a small pool. And then obviously the DNA part is just one piece. You intersect that with evidence from the investigation, a lot of other non-DNA things, and then that as an entirety leads to law enforcement solving a case.
And since what you do is even more specific, let's say, than some other DNA labs, are you involved in the extraction of DNA, or is the DNA first extracted and then sent to your lab, and then there you work your magic, which I could never understand?
So we actually can do all of it. We'll do whatever we're contracted to do, but what we tell law enforcement is that, you know, we like to call it evidence to answers. So we're actually the only lab in the United States that will apply this method, evidence to answers, fully in-house. And so we can take evidence. If you've already got an extract, we'll take an extract. We'll take whatever you got, and then we'll get the most that we can from it. And, you know, one other thing is that I guess the two things that are important to note is we're trying to capture tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of markers and data points in this data, in contrast to a traditional forensic test where you're looking at like 20 markers. So we're looking at tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of markers in an Othram test. And the second thing is that our goal is to capture as much information as possible from the least amount of evidence. Because as I was saying, if you consume the evidence or the evidence is gone or unsuitable, then the case truly goes cold. So our goal is not just to get that information, but to do it using the least amount of input evidence necessary. And that's valuable when you have a case that has very little DNA left, but it's even valuable in a contemporary case where you don't necessarily want to go exhaust your evidence or your budgets just running a bunch of stuff. So we've really optimized one test that can get a lot of information from very little input and then hopefully get the information the investigator needs to crack the case.
This is just fascinating, David. So we're going to talk about your case. I want to tell everyone what are the two cases we're going to focus on. And of course, your case is going to be at the top. This week, new details have emerged about Bethany Decker. That is a 21-year-old pregnant woman who was last seen in her Virginia apartment almost 10 years ago. We covered the case on Crime Watch Daily, and today we'll have the latest on that. But first, this is David's case. A 77-year-old suspect has been arrested in the killing of Texas cheerleader Carla Walker. He's now been indicted by a grand jury on a capital murder charge. Of course, David's our guest, and it's his lab that led the testing to get to this point. So here's what happened. Carla Walker was 17 years old, and she was a varsity cheerleader. This is 1974. Her boyfriend, Rodney McCoy, was the starting quarterback for his high school Texas football team. I mean, honestly, David, it's like, you know, the perfect happy high school couple that we're talking about. They'd gone to a Valentine's Day dance. They were in the parking lot of a bowling alley doing what it is that teenagers do after the dance, a romantic dance. And this is where this horrible assault takes place. Now, keep in mind, there was only a limited amount of evidence and a limited amount of information at the time. Apparently, the boyfriend says he's sitting in the car. All of a sudden, a guy shows up with a gun, is threatening them. Before you know it, the boyfriend has been hit in the back of the head and he passes out. And then Carla disappears. She's gone. She's taken. And no one knows what happened to her. 3 days later, her body is found. And according to the forensics at the time, Carla had been beaten, tortured, raped, and strangled. And the killer had injected her with morphine. It was a horrendous, horrendous case. So I think what's interesting here, David, is they were able to preserve some of her clothing and her bra. Are these the kinds of things, whatever it is that she had on her person, because I don't know how well they would have detailed, let's say, the car for forensics at that time in the 70s, is that what helped get to the bottom of this case?
Yeah, it's incredible if you think about it. It's 1974, right? So there were no DNA testing really methods for forensics, and for the investigators to have the foresight to well preserve and document all the evidence. I think is the reason that we were able to actually make any progress in the case. So I think it's incredible that even in the 70s, they were thinking very carefully about how to store this, store these items and make sure that they're all preserved. And, you know, the notes in this case are just extraordinary. And there's decades of work that was put together by generations of investigators that have tried to comb every little detail. So I think that was a huge, probably the most important factor in getting this case, resolved.
Right, because the DNA ultimately came from her clothing and from the bra she was wearing. And of course, you would say, like, how would another man's DNA be on her brassiere, especially when she has been sexually assaulted and all the other horrible things that have been done to her? Okay, what's interesting is at the time, they had a person of interest. And this person of interest has always been a person of interest, but police were never able to do much more with it. 2 months after Carla's murder, Glenn McCurley was questioned by police. Now, he told cops at the time that his gun had been stolen and he didn't report it to police because he was an ex-con and he had done some time for car theft, because apparently the type of weapon that was used and some ammunition was found at the scene connected back to a gun that he had. So he claimed that he had worked on the day of the murder until 4:30, and that he was a truck driver, and that the day after the murder, right, she still hadn't been found, that he was off. That was his day off. So really, what's interesting is that your DNA testing ultimately leads back to him, except you give the cops and the prosecutors the ammunition to finally arrest him. So let's talk a little bit about how this process happened. Our understanding is that you were able to generate a genetic profile using DNA that had been extracted from the victim's bra. So when you finally, did you come up with that, let's say, on the first pass? Did it actually indicate a person? Did it indicate a family of people?
Yeah, those are all good questions. So this case has been worked for decades, and we were not it's very common, actually, but Othram usually takes on cases, like I told you, after they failed elsewhere. And so we were not the first lab to look at this evidence. In this particular case, they had another lab had performed a DNA extraction, got DNA, and they had used other laboratories to attempt this kind of advanced testing to generate as much information as they could. And all the testing that they had performed had been unsuccessful, and basically because I believe they had mentioned the DNA was degraded. This happened prior to Othram's involvement, so I don't know all the details, but they had made attempts to use that DNA, and as such, they already had a DNA extract. They had consumed the majority of the DNA, and I could give you exact quantities, but it's...
When you say, no, that's okay, but I think it's really important for people to understand, it is, I think, perhaps you can explain it much better, is that when you extract the DNA, you're actually destroying a tiny bit of the evidence itself in order to get that DNA. Is that true?
Yeah. So you're consuming evidence to develop a DNA extract. And they had developed a few extracts, and they had one that had a lot of DNA. It was like tons of DNA. And that DNA all ended up getting used without producing an answer. And so this is one reason that, you know, I told you earlier, like we're really cautious about producing profiles with the least amount of evidence consumed possible, because you don't know if it'll work. It doesn't always work. And then even if it does work, you don't know if you'll need to do future testing. So I think the biggest danger in working these cold cases is to fully consume an extract, because as you said, the evidence is destroyed in the process of making that extract. And if you use up all the DNA and all the evidence, then you literally have nothing. And so the good news in this case is there was an inferior extract that was developed, had less DNA, wasn't as good, but it had remained and it was not suitable for testing anywhere. And so we took that evidence, and using that evidence, we built a profile of tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of markers. And what we were able to do with that is we were able to use genealogical databases to identify distant genetic relationships. And we took that, and then we applied it. We basically took these matches for which we know who those people are, and we know how they're related exactly, you know, in terms of like genetic distance to our unknown person. And then we take that information and we overlay it on a family tree. If you know the identity of the matches, and so you know where they go on a family tree, and then you know your unknown is a certain distance from those matches, then there's only a finite number of ways you can put the unknown on a family tree. And as you noted earlier, it's through a process of elimination that you basically prune the tree until you're left with only a few possibilities. It's different for every case, but in this specific case, what happened is we narrowed it down to a couple that had three sons. And so, I'll never forget, because this was on July 4th, it was on Saturday. My lab director, we work all the time. So my lab director called me. He's like, I think we have an interesting result. And mind you, the information about the weapon and these people that have been under, persons of interest, of which, by the way, there was many. It wasn't just this one guy. There was tons of folks. You can imagine he was not the only person in Fort Worth that owned a weapon that matched the description. So
correct.
We knew none of this information. We purposely blind ourselves so that the information we generate is truly orthogonal and separate from the information they have. So we call Jeff Bennett. So the detectives on the case were Jeff Bennett and Leo Wagner. I text Jeff and I say, I'm really sorry, it's July 4th, but do you have a minute to chat? And he's like, for this case, always. These two folks can't get enough credit for being on fire 24/7. And I really mean that. I'm a late night texter sometimes. They never fail to respond to a message. And so I told Jeff, I said, look, I think we have we're narrowing it down. We got a family. We'll see where else we can dig. But we tell him the surname and he's like, hang on a second. I have something in my notes. And remember, it's July 4th and he has his notes right next to him. So
of course he does. He's a good guy. Yeah.
Obviously working on this case, just like we are. And so we dig through it and he looks through and he goes, I have this gentleman who happens to be one of three brothers that we said would be candidates. And I said, well, it's interesting because, you know, he's identified this guy because of the sweep they did for folks that had a similar weapon. And we on a separate path used DNA. So at that point, they took over the investigation and they used the traditional testing methods then to confirm that, in fact, his 20 marker, as they would say, CODIS profile matched the crime scene. So, you know, it's also important to note that, you know, the crime scene itself, when they had developed the profile originally, they uploaded it to CODIS, but he's not in CODIS. He hasn't been convicted of a crime. So this is basically the way these two tests work together is CODIS is an amazing way to confirm that you are at a crime scene or that you belong to this DNA that's been left somewhere. But if you're not in the CODIS database, CODIS is a terrible way to find people. So what we do at Othram is we basically take these profiles that don't have known identities and we'll find them, but we always confirm it using the traditional framework. So Jeff and Leah actually in this case confirmed it a couple of different ways, a couple of different times, just very, very thorough work. And at some point, you know, they have enough evidence now that they approach the person of interest and, they talked to him and he ended up eventually confessing. And
I want to make two points. Most people who listen or watch our program are obsessed with crime. So they know what CODIS is, but for the few who don't, that's basically the criminal database that houses the DNA of convicted felons. And it's, you're in the system, you've been arrested. And the amazing thing is, you know, there are some people whose DNA, they're longtime criminals, but maybe they haven't been in the system unless there was a recent arrest. So it's an imperfect universe from which to pull your DNA. However, you know, you have a lot of repeat offenders. And it's interesting, you say it was July 4th, right? So July 4th, you get the pop, you call the cops. On July 7th, police collect some trash from Glenn McCurley's house. And then it was sent in for more analysis, right? Because they're like, okay, we're zeroing in on the guy. Then by September 10th, the cops go to McCurley's home and they say to him, we would like a DNA swab. Because, you know, procedurally, what investigators have to do is they have to have their own chain of custody and a chain of evidence as well as you, right? So they've got to obtain a good swab from him, not just, you know, you guys have kind of figured it out on the back end. Now they have to button everything up on the front end, right? So they managed to get two samples, two swabs, and then those were sent in. And then on September 16th, that's when the cops were notified that the DNA was an absolute match without question.
Yep.
Now, were you, when those swabs were sent in, were they sent into your lab? Is that, were you processing that at this point? Or then do you turn it over to, let's say, a government lab that has to do this for, again, chain of evidence, chain of custody?
So our lab supports chain of custody, but I love these kind of projects where you use a different lab and a different method, because it goes back to that earlier point about us not wanting to know about guns or about suspect lists. It's amazing when two laboratories using wildly different methods get the same answer. And so we encourage them to use the laboratory that developed the original profile, and this is the 20 marker profile, not what we generate. And they went back and did that, and they're in a different state. They have a whole different method, and they were able to produce information that, like you said, confirmed the results that we had. I think that's a lot more powerful. Sometimes when we're doing, particularly if we're working with like unidentified remains, and you can imagine CODIS is not very valuable for folks that are not criminals. If someone is found dead somewhere, hard to ID them. And so we will do additional testing to try to match relatives back to them. But in a case like this, where there's a criminal investigation, I think it's really important to have a traditional lab that does this for a living confirm, using a whole different set of people, methods, and everything else, the answer. And they're, of course, blinded to the work that we found. All they were told to do was to develop a profile, and match the two profiles together. So this is the best way that it can be handled.
It's just amazing. It's just amazing when you think of how everything in investigations and prosecutions has completely changed because of this technology. And the technology changes so quickly, even from 2 to 5 years. It's a massive change.
Yeah. There's folks, just to add, this guy is not a serial killer. He's not the typical, stereotypical villain you'd see in a TV show or a movie, right? Sometimes there are ordinary people that do terrible things and they hide in plain sight. And, those cases are very hard to work. There's not a pattern of behavior to build. It's not like the shows on TV. And so when you have someone that is ordinary, that has done something, unordinary or terrible, and then continues to hide in plain sight. I mean, he was living in the same area, a few miles from the victim's house for the last almost 50 years, then sometimes there is no other way to generate a lead other than to use these methods. And so we always work with investigators to exhaust every lead possible before they go to something like advanced DNA testing. But sometimes, like in these cases, you have to try something like this, because there's literally no other, the perpetrator and the suspect and the victim didn't even know each other. So,
right. And David, I'm curious, just slightly off topic, but do you find that more often the DNA testing that you do actually ends up clearing more people than actually, matching or identifying people, right? Because it's a tool that's being used both ways, to clear someone of having done something as well.
Yeah, in a traditional forensic test, you can either match or exclude somebody. What's nice about the kind of testing we're doing is we identify folks. So in identifying someone, we are simultaneously exonerating everyone else. We had another case. It was a story of Christine Jessup in Canada. This is a very similar case, girl that was sexually assaulted and murdered. But it was one of the most famous unsolved cases in Canada. And they had actually identified someone, and he ended up being wrongfully imprisoned. And he was exonerated based on original DNA kind of CODIS-style testing in the 90s. But when we helped investigators solve and actually figure out who actually committed the crime, he issued a statement to his attorney, and he said, the only true exoneration, because even after he was exonerated, people are still kind of looking at him weird. They're wondering, why was he even considered if he wasn't involved? And he said the true exoneration comes from identifying who's responsible. So I think that's the power of this method, is rather than saying you're a match or you're excluded, you're not a match, I think use this kind of testing to identify the truth, who is actually tied to that DNA. And then you can simultaneously seek justice and identify who's responsible. But then everyone else has been considered, and it could be a lot of people over a period of 50 years. All those other folks are cleared. I mean, certainly some folks, had wondered, if they were friends of Carla's that might have been involved. And identifying who did it and getting them into the legal system, having him confess and explain himself, it lifts even if you don't arrest someone, you know, it lifts the burden of even being considered as a person of interest for everyone else that had been in any way at all connected to that event.
Yes, indeed. And McCurley has been indicted by a grand jury, and he is currently being held in lieu of $500,000 bail. What's interesting here is you mentioned his side of the story. So he did a jailhouse interview with a local radio station, KRLD, and Glenn McCurley gave his side of the story to what happened in those early mornings of February 17th, 1974. McCurley said, quote, "I was drunk, really drunk. I was driving around, parking, drinking." McCurley claims that when he saw Carla and Rodney in the parking lot, he claims that he was hitting her, that Rodney, the boyfriend, was assaulting her. And he said, "I saw him, he was screaming, and I went over there, I opened the door, and I knocked him off of her." Now, here's the part. Let's just say that may be true, which we don't know. It's the next part that absolutely doesn't make any sense. He said, "I pulled her over into my car and I drove off." Okay, why, right? And then he said that he is the one who rescued Carla from her boyfriend instead of abducting her. He says, "We talked for a while, she calmed down, and she said that she was thankful for me getting him away from her." And then he adds this. So then, okay, right, so how did Carla end up dead? He said, "She just gave me a hug, I gave her a kiss, I mistook her for something else, I didn't mean to do it." Okay. None of that makes any sense unless you're going to tell me you were so out of it and so drunk, but still, to kill someone, to strangle them, to shoot them up with morphine, none of this makes any sense. His explanation is way too little too late. That's just me. Okay. Now, the other part of this, you know, we've been talking about the science and we've been talking about, okay, this is his version of events, is honestly, it's the family here. And you keep referring to the fact that in the 70s, there was no DNA technology. There was no such thing, really, in the way we discuss it, which also means there wasn't a lot of support for survivors and victims of crime. It was just a different time, a different place. So Jim Walker, who is Carla's brother, he says that the murder absolutely devastated his parents. He was only 12 at the time, and he says that he was bitter and filled with rage, and that over the decades, faith and community really helped him. In fact, he spoke so eloquently at the press conference announcing this arrest. I mean, honestly, he talks about how his faith was so strong that there is a group at the Capstone Church that would meet regularly just to pray for justice in this case. And we're talking about decades, right? 46 years of prayers. And I think, you know, look at this family, absolutely devastated. He said his mother and his father went into a terrible deep depression. He said back then there was no support for them. There were really no therapists for them. None of the advocate help that you get right now. It was a totally different time. And I read something that just really touched my heart. He said that the family had this beautiful portrait of their daughter hanging in the family home, and that every morning Carla's mother would touch it and say good morning. And so we can talk about science, but at the end of the day, what we're talking about is the lives of human beings and finally getting some sense of understanding and perhaps some justice as to what happened to their Carla.
Yeah, you know, it's miraculous that the person was still alive to be arrested and confirmed as the person involved. I wouldn't know what it was like to deal with that kind of a loss, but I would hope that Jim and the rest of the friends and family have, you know, some piece of closure or some amount of closure that allows them to move forward.
Yeah, I hope so. And, you know, this is just my thing. It's just so unbelievably unfair that the suspect, and he is just charged so far and indicted, that the suspect got to live his life for decades and do his thing. But not Carla, not Carla's family. No, they suffered. So I don't know what justice will be. And they counted every day. The brother said 46 years, 5 months, and 3 days, counting every single day. All right, That was incredible insight. I'm just curious, David, I know you're the scientist here, but do you ever then get to know the families? I know you get to know the investigators. Is that a weird world, or do you need to keep a wall there?
I speak to everyone involved. I speak to advocates. I speak to the families. I'll speak to law enforcement. It's it would be a lot easier and cleaner to just divide into one little piece and stay in the DNA lane. But the truth is, you know, this process is very collaborative and it's very iterative. And as you said, there's other aspects besides the science, which is like, you know, helping answer questions, explain things to family, and help them get as much as they can get from whatever little bit of piece they will get. So we talk to everyone. Our laboratory works for law enforcement. So we have to be hired and contracted through law enforcement for a law enforcement investigation. But we absolutely have relationships with the families of victims, friends, advocates. We work with a lot of law enforcement groups, and we do what we can. I mean, one silver lining in this case, and I think it's I think it's important, is that, you know, not every sex assault homicide has to go cold for 46 years. We have technology now that can drive these things forward. And you know, I'll give you a quick statistic if you want. You know, CODIS testing, which is again is an amazing technique and has led to a lot of successful case resolutions. It's like you said, if you're not in the database, you know, you can't be found. And just to give you a number on that, you're probably aware of the end the backlog, right? Push to clear these sex assault kits that need to be tested. So,
yes.
So you run a sex assault kit, and you use DNA testing to identify who might be responsible for the sex assault. The success rate of matching that to a known identity is 15%. And so 85% of the time, when you've done that, you actually haven't identified who the person is. And that's what happened with Carla Walker. Like they put it into CODIS, it just didn't match. And that's similarly what happened to some of these other cases. We announced Siobhan McGinnis, another sex assault homicide of a 5-year-old, and the DNA never matched in a criminal database. So there are, I just want to point it out that clearing the backlog is not the same thing as solving the backlog. And 85% of the sex assault kits that you push through this testing will still need work. And for all the reasons you mentioned, to you know, provide a little bit of closure, to help families, particularly on these cases that are on the edge, right? Late 70s, early 80s, people won't be around forever to wait for justice. Certainly the people that are suspected will not be around forever to answer for what's happened. And so I think there's an urgency to take this technology. That's why I do talk to families and to advocates, and I do want to share the news of what can be done, because I think there's an urgency to go work those cases. If CODIS can't get you an answer and you're in that 85% bucket, then you don't stop the case. You then flip to the next thing that you need to do, which is this advanced testing that we do at Othram, and you go figure out who the person is. Get the information you need to help law enforcement close the case so you don't have additional compounding tragedies. Because frankly, everyone in Carla's circle has become a secondary victim of that initial crime. And that's terrible. And that compounds the longer it takes to get a case closed.
Absolutely. Our second story is an update on a case that we covered on the TV show Crime Watch Daily. Bethany Decker was a young 21-year-old military wife. She was a mom. She had a toddler, a son. And then she suddenly went missing in 2011 while her husband was deployed in Afghanistan. The couple had been struggling in their marriage. That was obvious according to everyone in the family. Bethany was 5 months pregnant at the time of her disappearance. She also worked as a waitress because she was a full-time college student, so she was doing both. She was an honor student at the university. Family says very intelligent woman, worked super hard. All right. Bethany's disappearance was not reported for 3 weeks because what ended up happening was there were a bunch of Facebook postings and messages that appeared to seem to be coming from Bethany, but the English and the phrasing, none of it was right. And people started realizing, hold on a second, you're not Bethany. Where is Bethany? Hey, has anybody seen or heard from Bethany? So that's when all these folks started to call Bethany's mom. Mom said, you know what? Bethany's so busy, it is not unusual for me not to directly talk to her every day. But you know, these messages were coming in, so it appeared Bethany was alive. All right. So then on February 19th, 2011, Bethany's mother received you know, a bunch of phone calls from people she didn't know saying something is wrong with Facebook. So then she asked, Bethany's mom asked her mom. So Bethany's grandparents were asked to go check on her apartment in Ashburn, Virginia. Bethany's grandparents say that they found the car all dusty, parked kind of crooked with a flat tire. Never a good sign of what's to come. Apparently, it had been like that for some time. No one answered the door. At this point, the family panics. The mother calls the cops and says, something's happened to my daughter. We think she's missing. They go into the apartment and they're also tracking cell phones, checking to see if there's any activity on her credit cards. No activity on cell phone. No activity on credit cards. It's as if she has just completely disappeared. And as you and I know, people just don't disappear. A few people maybe want to disappear on purpose, but that is not the majority of these cases. Now, what I find interesting about this, David, as we go through this case is what is really missing from this case is the forensics, the DNA. That this is what is completely absent here. And you might be able to give us some insight into where it might actually be that we're not looking. I just want to talk about the case a little bit more. So they interview Bethany's husband, Emil, and he had seen her recently, but he was ultimately checked off the list as not a suspect. However, Bethany was having an affair. She had a boyfriend that she was living with. Remember, the marriage wasn't doing well. It's all this drama in someone's life that actually helps to piece a crime, kind of as DNA, if you will. It's like emotional DNA, I'm going to call it, that can help piece what's going on in a person's life. So they quickly zeroed in on someone called Ronald Roldan. So Bethany met Ronald while working at a restaurant. They began having an affair. And according to a local newspaper, it may have been his baby. We don't know for sure whose baby it was, but she was pregnant. So this guy was never charged. Like, no one really was charged. This case has been cold for years. And what's interesting is that now there has been an arrest, but the authorities are being very tight-lipped about why there's been arrest all of a sudden. And we don't believe at least, that forensics has played a role in this. So what do you do with a case like this where you have someone who's disappeared? They've never found her. They've never found her body. And the boyfriend, Roland, who's been arrested, he's not been charged with murder. This is not, it's not elevated to that yet. So where would they have, I guess I should ask it this way. When you're dealing with what appears to be a missing person and you're dealing with an adult, right? And people can take off. I always say it's in those first 24 to 48 hours where so much of the evidence is lost because cops always treat things as, you know, maybe she just took off. Maybe she was done. So they don't capture the forensics in time. Do you find that is an issue, let's say, for your more current cases?
Well, you know, our caseload is obviously biased towards either the remains of somebody or crime scene because we test DNA. But we have been involved and consulted on cases where, and it's a tricky kind of case where there's a suspected crime, but there's no body. So what do? You want to either to identify someone or to link someone to someone else using DNA with no body is a challenge. But ultimately, that body had to be taken somewhere, and maybe that body was that person was driven somewhere or somehow otherwise transported. That person would have come into contact with materials, and so sometimes in other cases, I don't know about this case. There are other items that can be examined for evidence or some trace kind of DNA that might suggest that the object or the item had come in contact with that person that's missing. And while it doesn't definitively prove that the person was murdered or not murdered, at least it can collect more evidence to tie the person who owns those items to the disappearance of that person. And sometimes it's enough to get, you know, folks talking and sometimes it's enough to identify new people of interest that might know something, but have, for whatever reason, not come forward earlier.
It's an interesting case in the sense that Bethany's family has made it absolutely clear that Ronald was abusive, very possessive and controlling, and that they were actually helping her to make a plan to get away from him. And we find often in these cases of domestic violence where there is a very violent and controlling individual in the relationship, that it is at the cusp of trying to get away or ending a relationship when so many of, let's say if she was murdered, where the murders or vicious attacks occur. It's like an inciting incident in a relationship like that. It's the most dangerous time, actually, during a domestic violence situation, is the moment the person who is suffering tries to get away, because then the other one just goes berserk. So even though police knew all of this, they did their forensics in a slightly different way, if you will. They did look into those Facebook postings. And when they traced back the IP address to all the postings that didn't make any sense under her name, well, they all went back to Roland's computer. But that still was not enough to arrest him. So he was always clearly a person of interest, but had never been named. All right, now, 10 years later, he's finally been charged. And what's interesting is he's been charged again with abduction. He has not been charged with her murder. Here's something that I think may be playing a role in all of this. It's so that's one thing, right? There's Bethany's case. Separate of that, Ronald had recently been released from a North Carolina prison. He was charged with attempted murder for a 2014 domestic violence attack on his then-girlfriend, Vicki Willoughby, in their North Carolina home. Ronald was arrested after brutally beating her, and he shot her 3 times and took out her eye. This is incredibly violent. On May 2016, he pleaded guilty to 2 reduced charges in North Carolina, felony assault with a deadly weapon and intent to kill by inflicting serious injury, and felony assault inflicting serious bodily injury. Crime Watch Daily talked to Vicki as part of Bethany's case to further understand what was going on. She describes her attack and she describes what happened that night. Here's a clip.
He used to have what I called outburst out of nowhere, rages of anger. And they would literally come out of nowhere.
One too many outbursts and then physical abuse had convinced Vicki to leave. But one November night, her plan to move on for good almost got her killed.
What happened on that Tuesday?
He came towards me in the living room, never said a word. He took my laptop and my phone out from in front of me, laid those aside. He grabbed me at the top of my hair and just started plummeting me with his right fist. Immediately snapped my neck, because that's the first thing I felt go. I felt it and I heard it.
With a broken neck, Vicki crawled to a nearby chair where she had hidden a gun.
I had such a fear Ronald was going to kill me. So that night, for some reason, I had 2 guns. One was under the dog bed, and one was in the chair in front of me.
She managed to reach it. But after shooting Roland twice, he was able to grab the gun from her and fire his own rounds. One grazed her arm, the other a direct hit to her head where the bullet stayed lodged.
After he shot me, I laid down for a moment. I stayed where I was because I thought I was going to die.
According to TV station WTOP, Ronald Roldan was extradited to Virginia on November 10th following the completion of his North Carolina case. So basically, after he's done serving time for assaulting Vicki and taking her eye out, he gets arrested immediately on this case, on Bethany's case. Now, one of the issues I do believe could be immigration. I think there's the possibility that once he exited the prison, that he may have been deported. So this is speculation on my part, but I got a feeling that authorities said, if we're ever going to get him, we got to get him right now. Mm-hmm. So the question is, will he cooperate and give us more information? Will someone else step forward? Or will he only be charged with kidnapping and not on the murder charge? Because he's not been charged with her murder. I mean, a case like this, you know, this one feels very, very cold, even though it's not nearly as old as Carla's case.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you're just not lucky enough to have, I mean, again, cases with no bodies, they're challenging. And you're not lucky enough to have the evidence that you need. I hope they have evidence, something, I guess. They must have something that, I guess, ties them maybe through this electronic records and everything else to her disappearance. But I think it's very hard to make a case for murder without a body. And if they're lucky, hopefully, and it was a murder, hopefully they find some forensic items, whether, you know, in his car or somewhere else. If he wasn't careful at Facebook posting, hopefully he was similarly not careful about how he, you know, disposed of the body if there was a murder, and they can comb through those items and find something. Because if there's DNA, you know, if you find DNA in the trunk of a car, if there's blood in the trunk of a car and it belongs to a person that's missing, it's not proof, but it's definitely suggestive that something, you know, people don't ordinarily ride in the backs of cars in the trunk.
No.
So,
right.
It would certainly build a case that something terrible had happened.
Well, I think also, you know, take into account here that this is a woman with a young child. So it's, you know, she just fell off the face of the earth. No, there's no way.
Yeah,
right.
It seems very suspicious at the least.
So we'll keep tabs on this one for everyone to figure out what more comes from this case that might actually put all the pieces together for us. It's time to move on to our comments section. So, David, this is the part of the program where we really talk about the crime cases that you all are talking about out there. A burglar makes pizza before fleeing a restaurant with the restaurant's delivery car. A thief took a break during his burglary of a Fullerton, California pizzeria. He stopped to make himself a pizza, and then he took off in the delivery car. Gotta love that. Very consistent here. The suspect later was identified as 25-year-old Oscar Sanchez, who broke into the Big Slice Pizzeria on November 8th. So he allegedly stole the cash and tablets that they had there, and security footage shows him stretching the dough at the restaurant's counter. They've charged him on suspicion of grand theft auto and second degree burglary, possession of burglary tools. I don't know if that's the pizza, and other crimes. Okay. So that's interesting in a case like that, where it's the surveillance video, right, that is the strongest evidence of a case. And this is part of the comments section. Justin D. writes, well, what toppings did he use? Cassandra G. writes, at least he wore gloves. Gotta love that, right? Our next one is, a Florida man tears up a drive-through because they forgot to put lettuce on his sandwich, okay? This is apparently what undid the man. Florida man threw a fit at a fast food restaurant because they didn't put lettuce on his sandwich. This is according to the Largo Police Department. Police say that they were called to a Checkers after employees reported that Henry R.C. Cabrillo, 49, was beating on the glass window of the drive-thru and he was screaming at employees. And the employees were not only afraid for themselves, they were afraid for all their customers. Finally, police show up. And the police ask the guy for ID. Okay, the beginnings of getting arrested, right? He refuses, and they're like, okay, buddy, we're taking you in. And as they try to put him in the patrol car, he resists arrest, so they charge him with that as well. Crystal M. writes, make your own damn sandwich, okay? And Maggie C. writes, do they serve lettuce in jail? He may get upset about that too. And Zena A., let us pray. He gets locked up. I always like those. The let us pray. Okay, that's really clever. David, thank you so much. This has been such an educational episode. Really, really fascinating the way you've just pulled the curtain behind how this works. I do want to ask you another question before we go, because, you know, obviously people are going to want to follow you and see what you're up to and what your lab is working on. So I'm curious of your opinion. You know, we hear a lot about citizen detectives, citizen sleuths, or people who are just really experts at genealogy. And I'm curious, in this world, this massive world where there are so many potential players, have you been impressed by some of the people who just, you know, do this as a hobby and manage to crack cases, along with people like you in your lab and your highly skilled scientists?
Yeah, it's just incredible. The power of the crowd is amazing. We, you know, we chronicle some of our adventures, either because we're crowdsourcing information or we crowdfund cases that otherwise can't get the proper funding. And we highlight even some of the cases like the one we discussed today and others on our website. It's dnasolves.com. So if you're curious about cases that either are in progress to being solved or have been solved and just want to take a look at them, we have a number of stories on dnasolves.com. But there's a lot of people that have been doing some amazing thing. And, you know, I have to tell you, like, genetic genealogy has been around for about 20 years, right? And it's been used to help, you know, adoptees find their parents, to learn amazing things about your family history. What's happening is in the last couple of years, we have this ability, as we talked about initially, to unlock information from evidence that just wasn't suitable. Even a few years ago, this evidence would not be suitable for testing. The Carla Walker evidence was not usable a few years ago. And in these last couple of years, we can unlock amazing information that could hold the clues to solving these cases. And so we work with a lot of different groups. You know, in the Carla Walker case is something that we did internally, but we also do cases where we partner with other folks that do things like genealogy and these other kinds of family tree building techniques. And so my position is, if you want to do all this great stuff, you need to have the right data. You need to have good data. So generate the most accurate profile you can, get the most information you can while consuming the least amount of evidence possible. And then it's available to the world, whether you're a citizen sleuth, whether you're within law enforcement, whether you're a company that specializes in this. Amazing things can happen if you can generate that information and unlock valuable information from evidence at these crime scenes. So our focus is primarily just digitizing evidence. How do we take the evidence of the crime scene and produce the information that everyone else you mentioned would need to solve a case? I would love to, you know, kind of imagine the Intel Inside kind of model, right? To just basically power the solves. We're not, there's too many cases for any one company to solve. Our goal is to digitize and preserve that information. And then we make it available to whoever our partner is to work that case to completion. So I love crowd. I love the internet. I love what can happen because especially in these investigations, it truly takes a village. So if you have an internet village of sleuths and other folks that are supporting a case, even just getting the word out. The last thing I'll tell you is, you know, there's a case that we got hired to work, and we announced it, and 2 days later, before we even got any DNA, we did nothing on the case. 2 days later, the details had, kind of made its way around the media, and the family recognized the details and came forward and were able to identify the person. This was a victim that had died and remained unidentified for years. So you never know. Like you said, it's not always DNA that solves it. There's many tools in your toolkit. Just getting the crowd to talk about a case could be the difference between a case staying cold and a case getting the attention it needs to get solved.
We're going to ask where people can find you. The website information, we will link to that. But last night on Twitter, I found you and I was looking through your Twitter feed and you're making a call for, hey, is anybody working on something like this? I love that. I love the nature of the direct communication of saying, okay, help me out here. I'm looking for this. Do you have this? Right? It's like this wonderful, you know, international virtual recipe that everyone's working toward perfecting. So, okay, give us the list again of all the places people can either follow you, your company, websites. Go ahead.
Okay, so the best place to learn about cases that we're working or have already worked would be DNA Solves. It's SOLVES.com, DNA Solves. You can follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is OthramTech, TECH. And you can also check out our company on the web, Othram.com. And so we spend a lot of time on web sleuths as well. We're try to be where we can as much as possible, and within the confines of what law enforcement allows, we try to be as transparent and collaborative with the crowd as possible. I love as you said that relationship that you can establish with everyone, gets everyone thinking about a case, talking about the case, and if you're lucky, bringing in the tips to law enforcement to help them crack a case. Because it usually will take more than just DNA. DNA is one piece, and then you integrate information from everywhere, and next thing you know it, a story unravels. So, and we're just excited at Othram to be part of that story.
Well, we're excited that you joined us today. This has been tremendous. I hope that you come back. We'd love to talk about more of your cases I think it's fascinating. Everyone wants to pull the curtain back and understand and figure out how'd you do that, right? Ooh. Terrific. So we hope you come back, David. Of course, you can find me, Anna G News, with one N, on all social media sites. You know I appreciate your comments. I love to hear your theories on cases that we cover, and you know I read your comments on YouTube. So as always, you can find our content on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and of course, YouTube. You can get updates by subscribing to our newsletter at truecrimedaily.com. Until next week, this is True Crime Daily, the podcast. I'm Anna Garcia, and as we always remind you, don't do crime.